At this time, I would like to welcome tonight our speaker, Steve Tillman, has been gracious enough to come speak for us tonight, and I'm going to call it from the Joys of Recovery home group, but new to town from North Carolina anyway. Please put your hands together.
Good evening. I'm happy to be here, and I'm happy there's so many Steves. I don't have too much more to remember. It makes it a lot easier. Cut my memory load of names just about in half. Thank you. I wanted to tell you that I'm just jump right in. I've got Mike over here that just gave me the word when I came in. I think he looked at me and said, "Oh, this is one of those drunk-a-log guys." And so when I get to 8:30, if I'm not past that drunk log, then y'all can get up and walk out or whatever the heck you want to do. I'll try and get past that. I have a sobriety date of March 8, 1976, and I've been sober 49 years. It'll be 50 this coming March. It's by the grace of God and the fellowship of this program that I'm sober. I came into AA when I was 26 years old, and I had gone through multiple jobs, torn apart a marriage, and was trying to reassemble it. I dropped out of school and dropped back in, and I had no future, and I reached a point in my life where all I wanted to do was drink. And then I reached a point where all I wanted to do was stop drinking, and I couldn't. And that was the beginning of the end for me as far as drinking. I had a lot of other drinking to do before that, before I finally got to the first drink. I was born in Denver, Colorado. We traveled around. Dad was in the military. I'll give you a little bit of background of my childhood, because a lot, and the longer I stayed sober, the more I have come to conclude or come to understand how much who we are, either in our sobriety or in our drinking, is determined by the characteristics of our childhood and the families that we grow up in and the things that are important to us or seem to be and so on. Does not mean that you're destined to be an alcoholic. It just means that there are great influences on you that will pull you in one way or another. But anyway, I was born in Denver, and we traveled around, and we ended up in Memphis, Tennessee. And the first experience I had with drinking was I was 6 years old, and I was at my grandfather's house. He was a watchmaker in Memphis, and he would take me to the Rushwood Park, and we could watch the Memphis Chicks playing baseball. And it was great. And he would buy me anything I wanted, and it was even greater. And we would go back to the house, and then his friend Lloyd would come over, and Lloyd and him would start watching the fights, Friday night fights, whatever, Saturday, Gillette, so on. And they would go into the bathroom, and they'd close the door, and they'd be laughing, carrying on, and my grandmother would come out and says, "Steve, don't listen to them. They're just dirty old men. You know, don't listen to them." And then they would come out, and they were in there sampling the alcohol that they'd taken in there. They'd always give me, "You want a sip, Steve? You want a sip?" And I said, "Yeah, I'll try some." And my grandmother would come in. She was watching for it. She said, "Now, Terry, don't you dare do that." And so I didn't get to taste it. And I remember the next experience with the alcohol was when I was 12 years old, and we had moved to Winston-Salem. My father had gotten a job there. And we moved to a nice house in a downtown area, and my mother was driving us. I had three sisters. I was the second in the run, and we drove past this place called Plaza Confectionery, and Plaza Confectionery was just this little shack up on it's near the Bob King automobile dealership now, but they would come out and they'd go in there and they would drink, and these men would stumble out, and this man came out, and I remember we were sitting there at a stoplight waiting to go, and he reaches around, sort of bends over, and he throws up the contents of his stomach, just barfed all over the ground. And then he reached down and he picked up his dentures, shook them off, and put them back in his mouth. And I said, "My God, did you see what he just did?" And she said, "That's an alcoholic." She didn't say an alcoholic, "That's a drunk. You can't be like him." I said, "God, I'll never be like that." And I made a vow right then and there, I would never drink like that. That I would never drink, because I knew, apparently I made that connection. Fast forward to 16 years old, and I decided that maybe I'm 16. I just got the driver's license and had the keys to the car, and I decided that that was a license to go out and drink. And it was back in the days where they would stop you for weaving and whatever, but they would always send you home with a pat on the back and tell you, don't, blah, blah, blah. And then if they got to know you, then they might arrest you for drunken driving. But it was not really this was well before
Mothers Against
Drunk Driving. Yeah, man. And it was well before that. And by the way, as an aside, when that came into being, I just thought that was horrible. I mean, who are these women doing coming in here and trying to ruin our drinking? You know, it's just boys out having fun. And anyway, I was driving that particular night, driving along, and a cop got behind me, and I had a, and I got pulled over. He's thinking, yeah, he's drinking a little like that, and weaving. So he came up and he got to talk, and he says, "Have you been drinking anything?" I said, "Oh yeah, I just had a beer, one beer." And that was the common response, one or two beers. And he said, "I think you've had a little bit more." And I said, "Well, sir, I'm blah, blah, blah." And I don't remember what I said, but I know he said, "You need to go home. So just drive your car. If you promise me you'll go home?" I said, "Yes, sir, I'll go straight home." That's about three blocks away. And I was so relieved that I turned around and I was walking back to my car, and I noticed, I was walking up to my car, and I noticed that one of his headlights was burned out. And so I said, "I'm going to have to help him out. I wanted to help him because he helped me, and I was going to go back there and tell him, you know, he got burned out headlight." I didn't realize that he was walking back the same way he was seeing the same thing I was seeing. And something told me, "Steve, just shut up and get in the car and go." And I did. But that was the kind of way that the drinking went for the first year. Actually, the very first beer or drink that I had, was driving a 55 Chevrolet. And it was Collins. And I had three guys in there with me, four people. And we went and we bought a six-pack of Tall Blue Ribbons. And those were 12-ounce. No, they didn't have 16-ounce. They had the 12s. And so anyway, we got in the car and I was driving. And what happened was that I couldn't find a church key. And that's what they call the can opener, church key. Sure. And so I had a screwdriver. And so I said, "Well, we'll just open it up and pound two holes, one on each side of the can." And those guys, each one of them took a drink. One of them drank a half a beer. The other two drank about three sips. And I took theirs and all the rest and drank it. And I loved it. It was something happened inside of me that just made me feel complete. It made me feel ecstatic, really, in a way. And I said to myself, "My God, I'm never going to be without this again." So I went from "I'll never drink" to "I'll never be without it" in a space of about 4.5 years. And that was just with a few samples beforehand. And I started drinking every weekend and every night that I had off during the middle of the week and summertime and so on. My dad made me work a lot. And that was fine, and I appreciate it now. In retrospect, I hated you for it. But I worked and did my jobs, and I would get the money, and then I would go out and I'd be drinking. And they knew something was going on, but they just didn't say anything. They just said, "Well, He'll drink that rot gut, and sooner or later he'll realize it's not good for him, and he'll quit. And I didn't quit. I just doubled down on it. And I don't think from then until when I began my first attempt to stop drinking 11 years later that I went a single day or weekend without drinking something. I just lived for it. It was more important to me than getting a date. It was more important to me than studying. And it was more important to me than jobs or anything like that. I wanted to drink. It just captured me. That's what it did. And I happened to make pretty good grades in school, and I happened to get lucky in a lot of ways. And my dad was pretty rough on me studying. He's an ex-military, and he was on me all the time. So I did my work, and then but I always did it with the idea that my reward is going to be I'm going to go out and get drunk tonight. And that's what happened. And when I reached, I went to college. Graduated from high school, and I got a full scholarship to a very good school, and paid everything, and I went in there, and the first day I went to class, the first time that they had orientation, freshman orientation, everybody came, and we were sitting around, and the dean was there, was one of the deans, and we lived in these dorms, Gothic-like dorms, and I was at the very tip top of one of the dorms. It was the spires and everything up there. Yeah. I thought this was pretty cool. And I got that. I got my papers and books and everything. And then I went down to the downstairs. And they said, are you ready to go to the meeting, first orientation? I said, I'm going to the meeting. So I got to go check out where the beer is, where the drinks are. So I went downtown to the Ivy Room, the famous Ivy Room. You know, and I asked the upperclassmen, said, where can I get drink? Oh, the Ivy Room. It's on the other end, other campus, and you just hop the bus from one campus to the other, and you walk about three blocks, and there it is. It's the best drink in town. I said, right. So I became a denizen of the Ivy Room, and actually got a part-time job in the Ivy Room when they fired me from the library. So I had a part-time job at the library, and that was a good job. And eventually, I got out of that and went to work for the Ivy Room. And it was pre-beer, just drinking constantly. I got introduced to marijuana. I remember that Linda Ronstadt came to the and the Stone Ponies came to the campus there, and they had this big concert. And I was walking from that top of that parapet of that tower down the steps, and it's like five stories down, and you go down in a circle, and we had been up in my room smoking dope, and he said, you feel anything? I said, yeah, I don't feel anything. Come about the second flight down, I started feeling a little something. By the time I got to the third flight down, I was just like stoned out of my gourd. And I was very small. About the same height that I am now, but I weighed about 20 pounds less than what I weigh now, and I don't weigh a lot. But I could just get high like that. And I started drinking and smoking marijuana too. And then marijuana, they were pretty tough on you. They did not want that in school, and they were going, where they would suspend you temporarily, and then they would kick you out of school. But we had connections there, and we would go up into different counties. We'd go up into Virginia and D.C., get what we needed, come back down to North Carolina. So anyway, the schooling went on, and by the end of the first semester, towards the end of the first semester, I had a 4.0 scale. I had a 0.2. And they said, have you thought that maybe this college isn't for you? And I said, no, I can't drop out. This is Vietnam War starting up here, and I don't want to go over there. I need a student deferment. And they said, well, you need to think about it, so you're out. And they suspended me, and they said, you come back. We're going to give you a year, whatever, do what you got to do, and So I got out of school, and I was out for the second semester, and my dad was furious. And I was trying to be independent and an adult, but I was depending completely on my parents and the other adults around me, and the voices over here that were saying, don't listen to them, blah, 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 and it was a very liberal atmosphere. Hell, Mondani, the new mayor of, I don't have an opinion one way or another about him, but the new communist or socialist mayor of New York, he was in the same place that I was and the people around me were when I was getting introduced into that way of thinking. And so I became an anti-war protester, and I became we took over the Allen Building, which was the administration building for the school, and we marched over to the president's home, and we barged in, about 100 of us, and we just took over his house. And he moved out, and eventually he retired and left, and they brought another one in, and we were disrupting classes, and it was, but I was back in school at that point. I'm sure they were happy to have me back. But I was in Naval ROTC, and they decided, I don't know why I stayed in it, but I did for about another semester, and finally I got to thinking about it, and I said, you know, I'm not going to fight for this country. This is a blah, 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 blah. You know, and I was very, very liberal, beyond liberal. And I finally decided that I would have to get out of the ROTC. And they came in and they said, well, we're about ready to suspend you anyway because you're the sorriest piece of S fecal matter that we've ever had in our unit here. And we don't want you to disgrace our flag and our unit and everything else. So we're happy you're gone. Just don't come back. You know, and that was my military experience. And so I went to a psychiatrist there that was specializing in getting young men out of the Army or the Air Force or whatever they were going to be in. And I had a couple of guys that just went ahead and enlisted that didn't want to go to school, and they just enlisted rather than going through all of the rigmarole I went through. But I got the psychiatrist to do a series of assessments of my mental capacity, and she came back with a diagnosis that I was incapable of. What did she say? She said, if you're incapable of following instructions, and you would be a very poor candidate to be in the military, you'd always be in trouble. And so they gave me a 4Y, which is the equivalent, it's not 4F, but it was to be called only in the event of a national emergency. And so I got out of Vietnam that way. And then they did the lottery, and I got a really high number in the lottery. I don't mean like a 1 or 2, I mean like a 300 and something. And so I dodged it that way, and I was quite pleased with myself, thinking I'd really done a lot for my country. And and I had a professor that wanted me to come to Canada and live up there with him and his wife, and then he had children, and go to graduate school with him. And he was pretty left-wing, and he subsequently is very conservative, and he's heads up a Jewish organization that supports Israel up in Canada at the same university. And but he wanted me to come up and study history with him up there, and so I said, oh, okay. But then in the meantime, I had decided that my grades weren't doing really well. I was kind of chugging along, but not too good. And I couldn't figure out what the problem was. I was never studying, that's what the problem was. And I could care less. I couldn't care less about studying. And so I decided I'm going to have to do something. I was in math and economics, and then I switched over to, I said, I got to get something a little bit easier. I love history. I'll just do history. It's easy, and I can quiz my way through. And I actually did pretty good. But I had to take some other liberal arts courses to stay in, keep myself in college. And so I took a course in Russian literature, of course, wouldn't be any other kind of literature. I had to have Russian literature. And it happened to be that the course was on Tolstoy's War and Peace, the longest novel written, I think, or close to it. And so I went into the class, and there was a Dr. Jezersky there, and he had a problem, an issue. He would come in, and sometimes he wouldn't come in. When he did, you couldn't understand a word he said because he was nipping a little bit, and he was drunk. And so we just sat around and talked, and then when he would come in and take and give us lectures, he said, I want you to know now, your grades are going to be determined by the final exam, and that's it, nothing else. You read the book, it's going to be tough, and blah, blah, blah. In the meantime, they let him go. But the new professor came in and took over the class. He said, well, we're just going to keep the same rules. And I had gone in and I decided, this is where the alcoholic thinking really, it's kicked in earlier, but it just, I was raising it to a high art form. You know, I wanted to make sure that I didn't have to do any of the stuff that I didn't think I needed to do. And so I went ahead and I looked for the prettiest woman I could find in that class, and then she was a knockout. So I sat next to her, and I made sure I was always, when I went to class, I went to about a third of them. You know, you're gonna need to pass a few. And I sat next to her, and she was taking absolutely spectacular, copious notes. And she knew that book from and backwards. She knew every character and every leitmotif and every theme and every metaphor. And I just looked at her and I said, this woman is brilliant. And so we got to talking and she said, how are you doing for studies 2 days before the exam, final exam? I said, well, I'm doing okay. I've still got to read the book. She said, what? She was like, you have to read the book? I said, yeah. And all of a sudden it clicked in my little mind up here, this manipulative little mind. I know how to get past that. I said, I've got a great idea. How are you doing on your? She said, well, I got to do some studying. I said, have you ever heard the story thought that the best way to study for something is to teach somebody else? She says, yeah, I've heard that. And I said, I need some help. And she said, well, you can get Cliff's notes. And I said, no, I can't. They've already warned us about Cliff's notes. You're going to get flunked automatically. So I went ahead and I said, how about if I make you dinner tonight? You come over to my apartment. I moved off campus a long time ago. That couldn't be regulated by them. I didn't want anything to do with them. And so I invited her over and she agreed. So we went to the AAP, came back with a bundle of groceries and lots of beer. And we sat down and we started studying and she walked me all the way through it. We spent 2 days, two nights there. And we got through War and Peace, we took the exam, and 2 days later they posted the grades on the professor's office window. And I had an A minus and she had a B plus. And she was just devastated. And I said, well, sometimes you know too much. You know, you just give them more than they need. And so she said, okay. So anyway, we fell in love that day. And 2 weeks later we were married. And I decided, well, got somebody that much of an asset, why are you going to kick her out? Get rid of her, you know, whatever. It was all about me. It's all about me. And then we had a baby 9 months after we got married. And that's who I'm living with now, by the way. I moved up here. You know, in a longer story. But anyway, am I time to get out? Is it time to get out? The trunk along? Okay. Bottom line is that we got married, we had babies, I went through jobs like crazy, I couldn't hold a job, and it was all because of the drinking. And I would hold a job for about 3 or 4 months, and then I would get fired from it. And I began to understand, I had friends of mine that came to me and said, Steve, this is what happened, what it was like, and it was just drinking all the time. And I said, I'm really not an alcoholic. And they said, well, why don't you go to an AA meeting? So I'm not going to any blank AA meeting. And so eventually, a few weeks later, I realized I really couldn't quit. So I went to an AA. I called. Here's what happened. I was sitting in a little dumpy little house we lived in. And she had taken my son and had gone to Florida, and she was saying she wasn't going to come back. And I'm sitting there, and the house is empty, food's gone. I saved beer cans because I don't know why. There was no recycling back then, but I saved them anyway. And I had just mounds of beer cans in my house. And I was sitting there drinking, and I had two beers left. And I was watching television, and there was a black and white set running, and I had a gun in my hand. I had a Luger that my father had gotten during World War II, and he had died, and I got his gun. And anyway, I was sitting there, the gun there, the beer can here, and the TV set here, and I am utterly and completely depressed. And my default when I get depressed like that is just go kill yourself. There's no reason to go on. You're clearly screwed up, and you're not going to be able to stop drinking. And drinking is really what keeps you alive anyway, and that's my crazy thinking. And so I went ahead and I sat there and put the gun up, and I put it up to my head. I'll never forget this. I put it up to my head, getting ready to just shoot myself in the temple. And a commercial came on television. And it said, "Are you having problems?" I said, "Yeah, I did. I am." So I put the gun down. He said, "Before you do something that's irreparable, call the crisis control number." It's the first one they ever had in Durham, North Carolina. And it's the first month that they had operated it. And just call 911, what 911 is a simple number to remember, like 687, somewhere or other. And let's talk about it. So I called the number, and they said, long talk. The woman that answered's name was Mary. My ex-wife's name was Mary. She was in Florida with the kids, and I thought she was fooling me. And so I said, "You're not my wife, are you?" She said, "I don't even know your name." "I'm Steve." And so anyway, she said, "How much do you drink?" And I said, "Oh, just a couple of beers now and then." And I would rather drink beer than anything because I thought I could control it. If I got the alcohol, and I would drink alcohol if I didn't have beer, I'd liquor, but it would just knock me off my socks. So I would control it. Alcohol came in slower amounts. It was titrated slower, I guess. I don't know. But anyway, I went ahead and she said, "Why don't you call this number?" And it was AA. And I called up AA, and she said, "I'm going to call you back in an hour to see if you really called them in." And that was about midnight. And the answering service there, they had an answering service. And they said, "This is AA," and blah, blah, blah. And so they had a guy call me up. He says, "Can you go without a drink between now and tomorrow morning?" I said, "Yeah, I can do that." And he said, "Because I only had two left." And so I went ahead, and I didn't pick up a drink, and he came over. First, I had to make sure before he came over that I was dressed in a suit and tie. I didn't want them to think that I was really a drunk or an alcoholic, for God's sake, you know. And I really was beginning to think I might have a drinking problem. And they came over, and he took me to an AA meeting, and he and another guy. And then it was like I walked into this room about this size, a little bit narrower, and I walked in, and everybody in there was laughing. And they were having a good time, and it was about this many, maybe 10 more than what's here now. It was incredible, and it was like, I just felt all of a sudden, it was the same feeling I had, except in the opposite end of the spectrum of when that alcohol was inside of me, and I felt like my solution was for life was there. And here it was, oh my God, this is where I want to be, not over here. I don't want to be in the alcohol side. I want to be in the sobriety side. Oh, long story short. I ended up in and out of AA for about 8 or 9 months, and I picked up like 14 white chips. I was in, and I was out, and I was in, and I was out, and I just couldn't believe that I was an alcoholic. And finally, decided I had to do something, and I went ahead and talked to a guy in Winston. He gave me my last white chip, which was March 8, 1976. And I asked him, I said, "Tony, he's been sober now almost 60 years. What's up in Elkin?" And I said, "Tony, what do I have to do to stay sober?" And he said, "Steve, you just took the first right step I've ever seen you take since I've known you." I said, "What?" He said, "You asked me how you could stay sober instead of telling me how I should stay sober." And so I really do that? And he says, "You really do that." He says, "You need to take the cotton out of your mouth, take it out of your ears and put it in your mouth, and sit down and shut up and listen." And I would start to say something in a meeting, "Well, I think that," and they would, these old timers would say, wait a minute, Steve says he thinks something over there. What do you guys think? He doesn't need to be talking, shut the beep up, you know, and they were mean to me. I couldn't believe it. I was a nice guy. You know, I was so self-centered and I was so full of myself, I couldn't hear what other people were saying. And it was miserable. So I finally decided you just gotta stop. And this is the whole key. I see lots of newcomers coming in all the time that they really want to have the benefits of not drinking. You know, and they want to be able to look somebody in the eye and feel good about themselves and whatever, but they can't guarantee, and I can't guarantee, all I can't guarantee is that just for today, 24 hours, I'll guarantee I won't have a drink today, because that's my commitment to me. But they can't get past that line, that stepping over that line. It's like a trap. It's like a trip line. You know, just when you get close enough to think you've got it made and you're going to be okay, you trip over the line and you go back out and start drinking again. And it gets worse and worse and worse. And mine was pretty bad. It was, my wife kicked me out. And we had more kids in the meantime, but she kicked me out anyway. She didn't care. She kicked me in the side of my, I still feel it sometimes. In my rib there, she broke something, and and I was lying on the porch throwing up, and she ended up basically saying, "I don't ever want to see you around here again." She came back eventually, and we got together for a couple more years, and it was beyond repair. One of the reasons beyond repair, she just didn't trust me. I had no currency with her at all, none. And I couldn't understand that. I was poor me, poor Steve, you know, and it just took me, I was like, what happened? I'm sober now, I've been sober about 4 years. Okay, and it's been by just guts, you know, had no higher power. I would go and I would listen to the steps and I read the book and all that, but I couldn't believe there was a God. I just could not get my hands around that. I thought I could prove to you, if I gave me enough time, that there is no God and that atheism was the way to go. You know, I had my Marxist philosophy in the back of my brain and that type of thing, which is nonsense. And I finally ended up at a point where 4 years sober, I married and I split up, took kids. She kicked me out, and I ended up living, I can't even remember where it was, but I was living. I had a job, and wasn't much, but I had a job. And I was sitting there in a meeting one night, and I just said, "This is just not working." And that's when I decided that gun was a pretty good idea. You should have used it a long time ago. And I'd sold the gun, of course, because I had to buy beer. But, so I had no gun, but I figured I could save up a little and go get one, get something, and I'd just kill myself again. And it was pretty depressing. I sat there and I read something in the big book that just resonated with me. It says somewhere in the big book, it says, "Have you ever gone out in the middle of the night and looked up in the starry skies, how deep they are and how huge they are and how small you are compared to it?" who are you to say that there isn't a God greater than you, or a power greater than you? And I couldn't answer it. I mean, I had no reason to think that I was greater than all of that, but I was trying to think that I was. And I ended up praying. And I didn't quite know what to do, and I changed jobs. I'd gone to work in television. I dropped out for about a year before I went back into the business. And I had a meeting with this is God, once you decide, and this is a higher power, you might choose to call God, pick what you want. I believe that there's power outside of me that exists, that has mine and everybody else, every other human being in the world has their best interest at heart and in mind. He wants none of us, he or she or it, wants none of us to be destroyed. He wants us to be healthy and happy and fulfilled and so on. And I finally decided that I just had to, God told me, F-A-I-T-H, forsaking all, I trust him. It means I have to give up everything. I have to give up literally everything. And if it's a job that's standing in your way, you quit the job. If it's a relationship that's standing in your way, you repair it or you get out of it. But you do it in a way that's humane and kind and loving. And you find ways to care for people any way you can, and that's how you stay sober, in my opinion. I ended up, with 4 years in, I called this person up, and I got a job selling insurance, and I did pretty good at it, but I was in their house, and there was this Last Supper picture of the Last Supper on the wall, and one of those velvet paintings, and I looked at both of them, Judy and Gray. And I looked at him, I said, you guys some kind of fundamentalists? And he said, what do you mean? I said, we got that picture up there. Are you fundamentalists? Are you fundies? And he said, do you mean that we believe in the fundamentals of Christianity? And I said, that's exactly what I mean. What is it? And he said, Judy, go put the coffee pot down. We're going to be here a while. And he's a country boy. And he was chewing his gum. He said, bring me another clean cup. Spit his tobacco in. She brought out a big mug of coffee and some cookies, and we stayed there from 9 p.m. to 2:30 a.m. And he went from Genesis to Revelation in this massive scan of the Bible and the story of God's redemptive powers and so on. And I'm not trying to turn this into a Sunday school class, because a lot of my beliefs have changed and shifted some, but the core of what he was talking about is still true. And to me, and I went back, and for the first time I actually prayed. Actually, God told me in AA one time, says, if you have trouble praying, just put your shoes under the bed when you go to bed that night. And while you're down there on your knees, when you get up in the morning, just stay there for a few more minutes and just pray. It won't hurt you. And so Judy, and Gray and Judy talked to me about it, and they finally said, Gray said, do you want to make a profession of faith? And I said, no, I got to think about this. I'm not ready to jump into that, you know. But that was the exact right thing at the right time. And that's how God works in my life. It shows up the right thing at the right time. And I went home, and my wife and kid were in Florida again. And they were trying to talk her into never coming back to the ne'er-do-well. And I actually prayed, and I said, God, I'm just really, 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 this is the third step prayer. I'm totally incapable of doing anything on my own. I have to have your help. And I just let it go. I'm lying there in that bed, and all of a sudden, it's about 3 a.m, I get this tingling in my ankles, my toes. And then it started tingling all the way up from calves, thighs, into my belly. And it was like this massive amount of energy inside of me was just rushing out of my mouth. And it was joy. absolute, total, complete joy. And I got so excited, I had tears in my eyes. There was a voice that came to me. You guys think I'm crazy as hell, but it's happened to me. And I'm jumping up and down on the bed, and I'm thanking God, and the voice says, "You're always with me. I will always be with you. You're in my hands." And I'm just going, and my life changed that minute. And do I have any more time? Five. Because several things like that have happened since then. I lost a granddaughter 7 years ago, and she was in the hospital. She spent 30 days in a hospital with a mold infection. She finally died after multiple amputations and so on, and she was 17. And they, you know, she wanted me there. I was there, and my family around me, the broken family we have, it was just, they were crazy. And I'm sitting there, and my son comes in and says they're not going to do any more because they can't fix it. It just can't be fixed. And I was sitting there, and suddenly, out of nowhere, just like, you've seen these columns of light from spectrums, from searchlights that shoot up and straight up in the sky. It started at her bed and went up and through the ceiling. And it was a sound of voices that said, "She's with us now, she's safe." And I knew, I was so sad, and I was crying because she was dying, but I was crying because she was also where she needed to be. She was beyond being hurt anymore. And she was where she needed it. And she's, I'm sure, a better place than I am right now. So those kinds of things happen just when you need them. Just when you need them. And I've come to depend on that. And I actually left my job in Winston-Salem. I sold the business. They didn't really sell it. They decided they didn't want to keep it open any longer because they weren't making any money because of lots of different factors came into it. So I just shut it down, and I moved up here. My son said, "Why don't you come live with us? We got room, blah, blah, blah." I said, "Okay, fine." And this has been the single, second or third largest transition I've made in my life. And I've had a lot of success in the broadcasting business and a lot of success in other sales. And I'm appreciative of it, and I'm happy for it. And I know that a lot of it, all of it really depends on a higher power. And me being willing to let go and let God do the work. So anyway, this has been hard, but every time I start falling, I go back and I look at the history of where I've been, and I've never picked up a drink since March 8th, 1976. And I have a single prayer every day. Sometimes I say it out loud, sometimes I say it just myself. It's that, "God, please don't let me pick up the first drink. Keep me away from that, because I don't know what to do if I get it inside of me. My body just completely shifts into a whole different gear. And I do not want to go back to live that way." And this program is the only way that I have ever found to quit and to stay quit. And I get a little irritated sometimes when they talk about, and I can see the value of it. When you say 90 meetings in 90 days, it's one meeting in one day. It's one day at a time. And I calculated them the other day, and I've been sober 18,150 days in a row. I can do it again. One more day is not going to be, it may be hard, but it is not, I'm not going to pick it up. And I have to come to these meetings, and I have to stay connected with you guys. And I can be all pontificating and thinking and writing and so on. And it's wonderful and it's good. But this is the platform, this is the boat, this is the ark that God's made for alcoholics. Thanks.
Steve, thank you. Appreciate you coming out tonight and sharing your story. that piece of finding God, right? And it's funny, I knew a guy that told a story about picking up enough white chips to tile a bathroom. And hearing some of those stories, like we were talking before the meeting tonight, just how similar a lot of these stories really are, right? I mean, even though they follow that same format, we all come from pretty different backgrounds, but we all kind of have the same story. And especially, I really loved you sharing the part about, you know, 3-4 years in the program, putting that thing down and really finally getting to that point of surrender. So